chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got quite a program for you this evening. We're going to start off with Laura Ingraham interviewing Tucker Carlson, and they're talking about a cleaner future. You know about this clean future they've been trying to sell us? Anyway, let's listen to see what they had to say.
So when Biden, Jennifer Granholm and company say that we're transitioning to a cleaner future, what they're really saying is they've added America's name to a growing global suicide pact. Joining me now is Tucker Carlson, host of Tucker Carlson Tonight and Tucker Carlson Originals on Fox Nation. His latest two-part series, Transgressive, The Cult of Confusion, is available now. Tucker, we're going to get to your new series in just a moment, but these aren't isolated incidents. It's easy to report on them as such. Well, this is happening in San Francisco. This is happening in Colorado, then in Britain, in France. But this is a global consensus building that we have to lower everybody's consumption and then standard of living.
Well, the global consensus is that a small group of people need to take control of energy. And energy is civilization. You don't have civilization without it. You know, civilizations grow, societies prosper with cheap energy, and they contract and wither without it. It's really that simple. So if you give control of your energy to someone, that person controls you completely. So energy is control. And I think we've had cheap energy for so long, we were energy independent about 20 minutes ago, that people don't understand how threatening this is and how close we are to being under the complete and total control of people who wish us ill.
Well, Tucker, when we think about electric vehicles, the point of electric vehicles in the minds of many is to limit how far people can travel. I mean, maybe someday batteries will be, you know, have longer mileage spans and so forth. But right now, for most electric cars, you can travel 250, 350 miles on one full charge.
Right.
Well, that limits how far people can go. That in and of itself is a limitation on the freedom of movement, which we're frankly guaranteed in our founding documents. Not anymore, apparently.
It's an attack on individual autonomy. By the way, they can also be turned off remotely without your compliance, right? And you can also be denied access to the electricity grid, as they just did in California. Sorry, the grid doesn't work. It's down. No, changing out, making illegal the gasoline engine is the single biggest change in the way Americans will live in our lifetimes. 10x. I mean, there's no bigger change than this. We're all sort of sitting there and be like, no, it's a good idea. By the way, electric vehicles are terrible for the environment. And I'm not talking about carbon emissions. The amount of mining required to get an electric vehicle far outstrips what you need to buy a Chevy Tahoe. So, like, the whole thing is a scam. It's only about control.
Now, Tucker, we have to move to this, two-part series on Fox Nation that you and your team have put together. It's called Transgressive, The Cult of Confusion. I want to show everybody a sneak peek. Watch.
Cults succeed because they make empty promises to wounded people.
It makes you cooler, hotter, and smarter than everyone else.
The promise is very straightforward. All your problems can be solved by changing your body. This is particularly appealing to lost teenagers. And the evangelists spreading that gospel are on TikTok.
Girls go online and they watch these videos now on TikTok. They're very well produced. They're very fun to watch. And the videos by trans influencers promise that if you just start a course of testosterone, everything's going to get a lot better. Your anxiety will get under control. You're in depression. You're going to feel great. And these girls are in a lot of very real pain. They're looking for a solution.
Now, Tucker, this is an issue that you and I, as parents, as Americans, share a similar level of passion and deep concern about. What did you learn new when you were making this?
That children across the country are being sexually mutilated, and that none of us are saying anything about it because we're so intimidated by the aggression and the lunacy of the advocates who are in favor of this. And the entire American media and virtually every institution in American life has been bullied into shutting up as children are sexually mutilated. And it's a moral crime. It should be a legal crime. It's beyond belief that this is actually happening. And, you know, I think anyone running for office, anyone holding office, has a moral duty to call this out and to ban it immediately and to punish people who are doing it. No doctor should be allowed to sexually mutilate a child, period, ever. And those doctors should be charged for the crimes they're committing, period. And I just don't know why no one's saying it. But when you look at what's actually happening, you slow down and just take a look at it. There's no defending it.
Well, Paul McHugh from Johns Hopkins, who did some of the most groundbreaking studies of what happens with individuals who've gone through these transformative surgeries, hormone blockers, et cetera, and you pointed this out. I mean, the level of suicide of people who've gone through this procedure post-puberty, years into their, quote, transition, that doesn't get discussed at all. At all.
Well, none of the details get discussed. And a lot of the details we couldn't put on television because they're too horrifying. We didn't want to put them on because they're too upsetting. The idea that you're born this way, really? But it's increased thousands of percent in the last 2 years? No. This is the product of a sustained propaganda campaign on social media designed to lure children into this, and then they're sterilized and sexually mutilated. Like, why are we putting up with this?
Tucker, I want to thank you for doing this. I want everyone to be sure to catch this series called Transgressive, The Cult of Confusion. It's available on Fox Nation now. And Tucker, most importantly, just thank you for staying up with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I love it. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
I don't want to make it out like you go to bed at like 9 o'clock every night, but you know, it's a little late, and you know, you're at least 42 now. So, Tucker, it's great to see you.
Great to see you, Laura.
Absolutely. Take care.
They're actually making sense with one another. Now, but after we play the next clip, I've got a couple of Hillary Clinton clips on an appearance she had on The View. And she talks about an authoritarian Trump or authoritarian Republican Party and so forth. And then there she talks about how to handle classified material and how it was handled when she was Secretary of State. But anyway, here's Laura Ingraham interviewing Rand Paul on a series of different issues. Very interesting what Rand Paul has to say. A fine stand-up senator.
I mean, that was Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. Senator, great to see you tonight. I think that more than past elections, this one really is about common sense and the left's utter rejection of it. Do you agree?
Yeah, and the thing is there's an enormous disconnect between those in Washington and those on the ground. Like in Kentucky, we lost 40 people to severe flooding recently in eastern Kentucky. Hundreds of homes were lost, and I was just out there. Not one person said, can you please send more money to Ukraine? They said, how come we're a rich country and we're having trouble digging our ditches, repairing our roads, and all of the basic functions of government, and yet the politicians in Washington want to send another $13 billion? After they send this $13 billion, we'll have sent over $50 billion to Ukraine. And people in eastern Kentucky are saying, how come we can't repair our bridges? How come we can't repair our roads? And so I find nobody in Kentucky coming up and say, please send more of our money overseas. And yet in Washington, it's not just Democrats. You got Democrats and all the Republican leadership lining up and saying, please send more of our money to Ukraine. But I'm not hearing it at home at all.
Now, you talk about that disconnect, Senator, and today President Biden unveiled one of his new so-called accomplishments.
Made in America is no longer just a slogan. Earlier this year, I went to Lockheed's factory in Alabama. They're making the Javelin missile that we're supplying to Ukraine.
Senator, how does the production of Javelin missiles for Ukraine help Americans? I guess,
you know,
the Americans at the factory, I guess.
Yeah, I've never really been big on looking at arms programs as jobs programs. I think that our weapons are uniquely owned by the taxpayer, even if private organizations make these. And when they shouldn't be something that's like, oh, well, let's give more weapons to create jobs by, you know, getting involved in more wars overseas. No, we don't really have the money to do this. We're $30 trillion in the hole, and it's inflationary. You borrow more money to buy weapons, it also causes inflation. And so really what I hear still around Kentucky and around the U.S. is, my gas costs so much, we can't go on vacation this year. The groceries cost so much. I'm a senior citizen. My check is getting thinner and thinner. I can't afford to do the things I want to do because of inflation. And they all instinctively know this is from the massive debts, the massive borrowing, and the huge COVID lockdowns and all the mistakes that were foisted upon us by Democrats, by Biden, by the Democrat Congress. And so I think there's a huge wave building. I really still think there's a huge wave building of discontent, and people are going to want to throw the bums out who have caused all this inflation.
Yeah, and everything's tightening. You see that with the Blake Masters race, 2 points or 3 points, new Emerson poll, Fetterman in Pennsylvania. And you've got your own race in Tennessee, Senator, but you've got a healthy lead. I know you're not taking anything for granted. I mean, Kentucky, excuse me. I don't know why I said Tennessee. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
now
I don't know what my lead is like in Tennessee, Yankee at heart. But my lead in Kentucky.
I got you.
Yeah,
I got you.
We are fighting hard in Kentucky, and things are narrowing across the U.S., but we're fighting hard here. And if people want to go to randpaul.com, they can find out more about our race. But we're fighting hard to let people know that I'm a different kind of Republican. I'm a kind of Republican that doesn't fly around the world at taxpayer expense. I'm a kind of Republican who also says, you know what, I'm going to give money back to the Treasury from my office. I'm not going to spend all the money they give me. I'm going to give back. So my office has actually given back over $5 million to the Treasury.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I'm going to tweet out your new ad, Senator, which I just saw, which is fantastic. I don't know who made that ad for you, but now everybody's going to be curious, so they're going to have to go to my Twitter to see it. Senator, fantastic to see you. Haven't seen you in a while, so thank you so much.
Laura Ingraham has gotten very, very good. I haven't been putting up many of her clips, but I'm going to have to start looking at her more closely because she does some fine work. She started out with a radio program and worked her way up to Fox, and she does a really fine job. I've got a couple of clips here. Hillary Clinton was on The View recently, and the first clip is about how to handle, or how she handled, they asked her a question about Trump and these folders that were empty and so forth, and she came back and lectured for just a short period there about how she handled, or how carefully everyone was, you know, about how classified, you know, documents were handled. Of course, she had an illegal server with classified information on it, but that's beside the point, see. That was, you know, under the carpet, swept under the carpet. But here we go about she telling us about classified materials after she was asked a question about Trump, that raid on Mar-a-Lago, and all those classified documents down there. So here we go with Hillary.
So the FBI seized more than 11,000 documents from Mar-a-Lago. It's 11,000.
Like
that we know of right now.
Yeah,
325 of the documents retrieved since Trump left office were marked classified. There were also 40-some-odd folders that were empty that were also marked classified. Mm. What was your hot take when you heard about this?
Well, look, I mean, I think this should be taken really seriously.
Yeah.
And it's not a joking matter.
And it shouldn't be partisan.
No. And it shouldn't be partisan. No. It should concern every American because those documents and the empty folders, as they were marked, suggest that there was really important secret information that is essential to our country's defense and security. And when the report came out yesterday that the documents also included information about, we don't know which, an ally or an adversary's nuclear program, I cannot tell you how terrifying that is.
Yeah,
and, Alyssa, you know, because you were at the Defense Department. You know, there were times when I was Secretary of State that literally a military courier would come into my office. It would be an emergency. There wouldn't be time to get to the White House and mm-hmm. have a meeting in a what's called a SCIF, a secured facility. So usually a man, it was always a man as I remember, walked in. He would have like a briefcase locked to his wrist. Mm-hmm. And he would come into my office and he would say, you have to look at this immediately, Secretary. He would unlock the briefcase. He would stand there. He would give me this document that had really delicate, secret information about something of importance. I would read it. Then I would sign that I had read it. It would go back into the locked box, attached to his wrist, and off he would go. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how these documents ended up where they are. Mm-hmm. I yeah. don't understand how he was permitted to take them even to the residence, let alone to a country club in Florida. I don't understand it.
Well, where was the guy with the lockbox?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking. I don't know.
What happened to him?
I don't know.
And the missing documents.
I don't know. And it's, you know, we don't have yet an understanding of what was in them. We're getting little dribs and drabs like the nuclear posture of an ally or an adversary. But I do, I mean, people literally die to get our government information. Mm-hmm. They go to prison.
Yeah.
They get exiled. It's dangerous oftentimes. And the idea that this would have been done, I hope everybody takes really seriously. It is not some casual try to come up with some, you know, throwaway.
It's not like an overdue library book.
No, not like an overdue library
book. You know, hell, you know,
Okay, Hillary, how about all that illegal stuff you had on those illegal servers that you had? Okay. Okay, her next clip is that she makes a statement about Trump, you know, being dangerous, or the Republican Party being authoritarian and so forth and dangerous. Here we go with that statement. This was on The View recently, too.
Madam Secretary, thank you for being here, Chelsea. So this past week, as President Biden gave a speech on democracy and the threats to it, as a Republican, I've been outspoken that I think it's one of the biggest issues facing our country. But I did worry that by using the language saying many who support the former president are semi-fascist or leaning toward it was divisive. I know you experienced when you used the term deplorables quite a bit of backlash from the right. Do you think the president met the right tone, or do you think that this was divisive and could have been framed better?
You know, I think he did a very important service to the country in giving the speech that he gave, because too many people are not yet aware of how fragile our democracy is. Mm. And I'm not going to second guess the language he used, because there has been so much that has gone beyond anything I ever would have dreamed of, starting with January 6th, but so many threats of violence and mm-hmm. you know, concerns that people are expressing about the country, you know, coming apart and all of that. So I think he did a real service, and I personally thought it was a strong and necessary speech, and mm-hmm. I would not second guess any of the language. The final thing I would say is, you know, look, fascism is a very big word. I know mm-hmm. that. But so is socialism, and the Republicans call every Democrat who wants people to have health care a socialist. Mm-hmm. So I think we do need to be careful with our language, but I think the problem is if you go through the hallmarks of authoritarian regimes, mm-hmm. You see too many characteristics, unfortunately, on our Republican side. And my most fervent hope is that Republicans themselves will begin to reject all of that verbally, vocally in their voting, and, you know, kind of reconstitute the Republican Party to where it used to be and not the, you know, party of Trump, which I think is very dangerous to the country.
Hillary also said glowing, compliments about, you know, Biden's speech last Thursday, it was just decidedly a very terrible, terrible speech and frankly, very, very dangerous and very, very threatening speech that it was given. We've got a serious clip here. Susan Swift out of California, she's for life. She stands up for life. And here's what she had to say about 15 bills have been passed. And then some being signed already by Newsom and some waiting to be signed, but they're about abortion, and they're going to start flying people in for free abortions in California. And also, you know, a month after the child is delivered, they're able to extinguish that life and so forth. It's very dangerous waters. But here we go with Susan Swift and Alex.
What would you call the current state of the battle for the unborn and for the soul of America?
Well, we are witnessing the California abortion apocalypse. It is unfolding right now. What has happened over the last 6 months is that the Future of Abortion Council, this is 40, I call them the abortion cartel, about 40 different abortion providers, they saw that their market share was going to be crippled by the Dobbs overturning of Roe versus Wade. And they went into action. This is back in probably November, December last year. And they said, well, we've got to boost up our market share. What are we going to do? They got together with Governor Gavin Newsom, who's the governor of California here, and they came out with a plan called the Future of Abortion Recommendations, 15 specific points, and they started advancing legislation. They've gotten them all through, 90% of them. There's at least 15 bills that they've already gotten all through. They're all enrolled. They're in various stages of just waiting to get to Governor Newsom's desk. And what this is as he starts signing them, this is ushering in an abortion apocalypse. It is abortion on demand, 24/7, no limits, and we'll fly you in here to California. It's free abortions, free travel, lost wages, you cover your insurance, hotel accommodations, and even child care. I kid you not. So just bring the kids you want to keep, because you can abort the one that's inside, right? Just keep the ones you want. That's just one bill. That's SB 1142. That's part of the budget now for California. Another bill that they have advanced and is now, it's already enrolled, and I believe it's just waiting for the signature of the governor to be chaptered. That's AB 2223. That's the infanticide bill. That's what's going to decriminalize infanticide for all 9 months of pregnancy through delivery and into the first 28 days of birth after the baby is born. And I'll explain how this works, because they wanted to decriminalize any kind of prosecution of a woman for a miscarriage, for stillbirth, abortion. And the fourth category is perinatal death due to causes that occur in utero. That's not defined, but I do know what perinatal death means. Perinatal is after birth. Prenatal is before birth. Perinatal is after birth. And in California law, the perinatal period is already defined. It is defined as the moment of conception through the first month of a child's life. So perinatal period starts, right, you know, from delivery on for at least 28 more days, and they decided to weave that into this category, perinatal death due to causes that occur in utero. We kept asking them, well, what does that mean? Please strike that out, because we think that means after birth abortions, right? This is how to finish off a botched abortion. That's what AB 2223 is going to do. It's going to make it impossible to investigate a mother, a pregnant person, anyone who wants to pretend to be a pregnant person. Anyway, it'll protect the mother and anyone who assists her in her chosen pregnancy outcome. So that's grandma, that's boyfriend, that's an abortionist, that's a nurse, anyone who assists her. They are all protected from any kind of civil or criminal liability. Can't investigate them, because if you do, you can be charged with a private cause of action, civil damages, $25,000 plus court costs and attorney's fees. So practically speaking, what this is going to do is it's going to prevent anyone from even investigating or asking about, well, how did this baby die? And here's the interesting thing about AB 2223. It has already now stripped away the pre-existing laws in California. In California right now, until AB 2223 is officially signed and in effect, in California, we have the Roe versus Wade model, which is a woman has an absolute right to abortion up to viability. And then after viability, she has a right to abortion if the pregnancy endangers her health or welfare, or anything like that. It's a rubber stamp, but at least she has to go into a doctor. At least it exists that at around viability, you have to at least be seen by a doctor. And maybe it's even a pretense, but at least there's that in the law. AB 2223 does away with all that. It's going to legalize abortion on demand up through all 9 months of pregnancy and into a fourth trimester, which is after birth, perinatal death due to causes that occur in utero. Those are just two bills that are happening in California. So we're going to see women flying in here and being brought in here. I think it's human trafficking, because what they do is they harvest those babies, those living babies, and they sell the baby parts. We know that from the David DeLuyden films, right? So we're going to be having abortions on demand. And just like Governor Northam, the former governor of Virginia, said, well, let's say we have a botched abortion, either a chemical abortion where the woman takes the chemical pills, Mifeprex and Misoprostol, and she delivers a baby, right? And it's still alive. That happens sometimes when you have chemical abortions or when you have surgical abortions. The babies are sometimes born alive. At that point, because of AB 2223, they can let that baby die on a table or they can smother it, so long as someone can point to the cause that occurred in utero, like the abortion that got botched, right? As long as you point to that, practically speaking, no one's going to investigate it so long as the mother is consenting.
All right, stay right there. And this will incentivize even women going in to have babies. They're going to kill them. We'll be right back. Stay with us. What do you think it's really about? Why are they out in the open, and how do we stop them?
I think you're absolutely right, Alex. This is about the money. This is about depopulation and trying to fund it and create a business around the depopulation of human beings. So, yes, I think they are selling baby parts, and they're using your taxpayer dollars to do it. Not just the taxpayer dollars in California, by the way, but all taxpayers, because the Biden blue state bailout sent a ton of money to California and other blue states. Our surplus right now in California is close to $100 billion. If they wanted to actually end abortion by coming alongside women and caring for them and ministering to them, or at least educating young men and young women and saying, hey, let's not have a need for abortion ever again. These are human beings. These are little tiny carbon footprints that they're trying to get rid of. And they're using your taxpayer dollars to do it. That's the problem here, because this is an industry. As I said, they've lost 27 states, right? They've lost half of their market share. So now that they're centralizing in California and other states as well, trying to pass an abortion amendment to the state constitution, which is just, it's a lot of virtue signaling, because they already have laws in California that make abortion a constitutional right, according to the California State Supreme Court. And this is unholy. Abortion is an unholy sacrament to empower, I think, spiritually, this domination of our population. Instead of liberty and life, we are celebrating this domination, control, and death. That's what abortion is. And let me clear something up right now. Abortion is not health care. That's the lie. That is the biggest lie that the abortion cartel will tell you. It is not health care. Abortion is the intentional killing of a human being in the womb. That's what it is. Its purpose, the purpose of abortion, is not health care. The purpose is specifically to target and eliminate that human being.
Susan Swift is a stand-up lady. She says it like it is. They're dealing in these body parts, these children parts, these baby body parts. And there was a Veritas that exposed some of this in the past. But very, very wicked stuff. And so we just have to support people like Susan Swift. And she's done a marvelous job in struggling against it. She has clinics and gives advice to people that want to stay on the life, pro-life side. Anyway, I found a Jimmy Savile clip. It was on a documentary that Channel 5 over there aired a few years ago. And I picked up about the first 9 minutes of it. But I'm going to put up on my site, thesecrettruth.com, a click off where you can go in and view the whole documentary about Jimmy Savile. He was started out as a DJ, disc jockey, and worked his way up and was hobnobbing with the elite, cream de la cream of the majesty, you know, force up there. You know, you could say the majestic leaders of our world out of London there. But anyway, it's very revealing, and Jimmy Savile had friendships concerning pedophilia with some of the top leaders in UK. So here we go with a short clip, and you can find it on my site, thesecrettruth.com, and look at the whole documentary there.
For years, he was a TV and radio superstar and a friend of the rich and famous.
He was pretty much ingrained in the nation's consciousness.
Nobody tells me to do anything, baby.
Oh,
I tell them what's happening.
He had friends in the very highest echelons of society.
But since his death in 2011, the sinister truth about Jimmy Savile has been revealed.
He was just sadistic in what he wanted to do and what he wanted other people to do.
Jimmy Savile, once one of the nation's favorite stars, adored by millions of TV viewers, is now regarded as one of the country's most prolific sex offenders. His preying on young victims and just how he was allowed to carry on abusing children for decades are crimes that shook Britain. On the 9th of November, 2011, a funeral cortege moved slowly through the city of Leeds. The streets lined by a respectful public. They weren't there to say goodbye to royalty or a head of state, however. They'd come to pay their respects to a DJ, charity worker, and much-loved icon.
They were absolutely worshipped by thousands and thousands of people. You couldn't move in Leeds when it was a funeral. The streets were packed solid, you know, traffic was stopped, everything stopped.
At 2 this afternoon, Sir Jimmy Savile's gold coffin made its way down Cookridge Street in Leeds.
I can't think of any media celebrity today who is more famous than he was then.
Flags at half-mast outside Leeds General Infirmary, where he'd raised so much for charity.
He was a demigod.
Just days later, however, stories began to emerge that confounded the country. Rumours that had circulated for years were coming true. Jimmy Savile, once the nation's favourite entertainer, was in fact a rapist, a sadist, and a paedophile. Jimmy Savile was born in Leeds on the 31st of October, 1926. As a young man, he worked as a coal miner before an injury forced him to change career. He became an entertainer and began running several nightclubs in the north of England. It wasn't long before his reputation preceded him.
When Jimmy Savile first came to Leeds, no one knew him. And after a month, everybody in Leeds knew him or have heard of him because of the outlandish things that he used to do. The way he dressed, the way he did his hair, for instance. You know, just to get himself noticed.
You know, if he came to our house, there'd obviously be a couple of, I'd say a couple of dozen, it could be a couple of hundred people all outside the house and round his car. And, you know, so you'd obviously walk around with a big chest and your head held high, you know, saying, oh, is that my uncle, sort of thing. We never went out saying, I've got a famous uncle called Jimmy Savile or all like that. He was just Uncle Jimmy and that were it, really.
He was a well-known figure in the north of England. He was a sort of an amateur disc jockey who hadn't really broken into television yet.
And he introduced dancing to records, which had never happened before. He started for younger people on a lunchtime, just dancing to records, and it really took off.
Jimmy Savile began working at the Locarno nightclub in Leeds in the late 1950s. Dennis Lemon was employed by the club and became Savile's unofficial minder.
He tried to give himself this reputation of a tough guy and a wrestler and all this, that and other, and I think he's as soft as anything. He just wanted somebody at his shoulders in case somebody did take a swing.
Even as his showbiz career was taking off, Jimmy Savile began to be dogged by accusations.
When I was talking to the assistant manager one night, and Jimmy came through and through the door, and evening, Jimmy, you know, I just walked straight past us. And I said, what's wrong with Jimmy? He said, he's got a lot on his mind.
So what's wrong with him now? He says, in court tomorrow. What for? He says, messing about with girls. And I thought, well, he may have taken one out and, as the phrase goes, tried it on and it didn't work and they've complained about him, you know. And that was that. Nothing else said. Until next time I was on duty, a couple of nights later, and I happened to say, how did Jimmy go on in court? So I said, oh, I never got to court. It got thrown out. Case dropped. And I said, how did he manage that one then? He said, same as he did last time. He said he paid him off.
Having narrowly escaped any charges by paying off his accuser's family, Saville apparently felt no need to curb his behaviour.
What's amazing is how brazen he was, how public he was, even then. I think he's just an individual who probably felt that he was fairly untouchable. I mean, you know, he was quite an imposing figure.
In 1968, 15-year-old Guy Marsden, Saville's nephew, along with three friends, headed south from Leeds in search of adventure. The young teenagers found themselves at Euston Station in London, where they were approached by two men.
I would have said about 30 years old, rock and roll, with leather jackets and long hair and that. And they were just saying, do you want to come to our place and that? You've got to try to remember that there were no such thing as perverts. There were, but you didn't hear of them. They weren't even a name paedophile out then, I don't think. So we just thought, oh, like us, you know. So anyway, we ended up going with these back to their flat.
At the time, Guy and his friends were unaware of the motives of the two men. Only recently has he found out the truth.
These people would pick people up from train stations, as in younger people. We'd then go to their houses. And then the ones higher up the chain would come to these houses to see all they'd picked up, to take them elsewhere to do whatever they were going to do with them.
Only days later, Guy was stunned when Jimmy Saville himself visited the flat. His first thought was that his family had tracked him down and they had sent Saville to bring him back to Leeds. The truth would be far worse.
And then my Uncle Jimmy came in, and he came in with his vicar and some kids. I thought that my Uncle Jimmy had caught me there because, I mean, I was proper scared, if you know what I mean, I was terrified, if you want. But now, I'm 60, I think. He didn't catch me, I caught him.
Only recently has Guy been made aware that Jimmy Saville, far from being a lone predator, seemingly played an active role in supplying children to a network of child abusers in London.
Now, I have no conception of paedophilia or child abuse at all, neither has any other thing. So to us, our thoughts were, it's a party. You know, the people who live there, the man and lady who live there, are going to have a party. And it ended up where we were like huddled together, four of us, and then these little kids would come over to us.
As a naive 15-year-old, Guy was never completely aware of the role he played. But it appears he and his friends were unwitting accomplices in the group's depraved activities.
You'd have been talking from 6-year-old up to, I'd have said, 10 at most. So there were young children. And every so often, one of them would go, two of them would go. Still never thought nothing whatsoever about it.
These parties would last for days, with various men from all sections of society arriving and taking one or more young children into bedrooms and abusing them.
I think most decent people find it incomprehensible that these sort of organisations, rings, whatever we want to call them, exist. But no less incomprehensible than why would anybody abuse a child? That the fact that people come together to do it seems in a way somewhat more scary, because very often we're talking about people from, well, certainly people from all walks of life, but including people from the upper echelons of society.
I hope you can follow that, but you can come back into thesecrettruth.com and see the whole thing. Next coming up is Jay Dyer, and he's talking about the changing images of man. And Willis Harmon had written a series of different books and articles and so forth. He talks about individualism versus the collective. And what Willis Harmon was saying is that we need to have some kind of fiefdom out there, you know, some kind of a new feudal system, you know. But this changing images of man was published out of California a number of years ago in the 70s. And it sets out what types of philosophies and religious movement that we need to diss and what we need to get back to is a perennial philosophy that was espoused by Aldous Huxley and other New Agers and esoteric type thinkers. But here we go with Jay Dyer, and then you'll hear the closing music. Come on, we'll be out of here at that time. Thank you for listening to The Secret Truth.
Welcome back to the 1800s. You are going to enjoy the 1800s. You live in the little house on the prairie. You will be churning the butter. You will be sewing the New Balance sneakers for yourself. It will be great. It will be great for the environment. You're going to live in little house on the prairie. You will have the greasy, oily Michael Landon out front in the Amish tank top. He will be chopping the wood for you to heat your house. After that, we will kill you.
It's going to be great living in a little house on a prairie. I've always wanted to watch Michael Landon chopping wood outside. We got to get those numbers down. And when we're able to sew our own New Balance sneakers, we're going to save Mother Earth.
Listen, that's not a joke. That is a joke, but it's not a joke. But it is a joke. And that's because that's actually what's in this piece about the post-industrial society and austerity being brought in by design after catastrophes. Oh, I wonder what catastrophes.
This great reset is the perfect excuse for us to bring in the new world order.
So what is this going to look like? What is this circular economy that we keep hearing about? And so I'm going to get into more of that from the Millennium Essay from Willis Harmon. In this technocratic society, how predictive it was, especially for the CUFID era and for what we see in Operation Lockstep and what we see being rolled out right now, post-Great Reset, or at least the initial phases of this. What have we seen in the last few weeks, right? What did Alex cover all week long? Shutting off power grids, shutting off water, shutting down farms, factory farms, cows. You can't have your own cattle. You can't have your own food sources, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all by design because as Willis Harmon wrote, following the Stanford research plans from the 1970s, again following the Royal Society British Imperial Malthusian plan from decades prior to that, centuries prior to that, the post-industrial society, he says, begins with the idea of a universal welfare system based on some kind of token given out. That will be the central bank digital currency. The Bank for National Settlements will probably have some attempt at an international universal based income. It'll probably roll out through the tech companies, through, you know, Facebook and things like this. And it says that everybody will be on welfare because, again, remember, what did we see with the placing of the American Indians on welfare and then the black community on welfare? I'm not saying that there can't be a legitimate place for welfare or something like that. But the point is rather that even though these communities might have been due some aid for what they've gone through, the real reason that the government, the federal government and the Federal Reserve, et cetera, were putting people on these was not actually to help them, but was rather to control and enslave them. Now that model, and if you remember Alex way a long time ago, back in the day, he used to have Russell Means on, and Russell Means would always make this very point that the model that they use for the Native Americans is exactly the model that the New World Order will use for the entire world. He was way ahead of his time on that point. That was perfectly accurate. And again, the point is not that welfare is bad or that people shouldn't get assistance when they need it. The point is that the intention of giving everyone welfare in various communities and then expanding that to the world for a universal basic income is not so that you can lay around in your coon pod and have fun all day playing video games and sleeping with dragons in the metaverse. That's not what the purpose of it is. The purpose is control and enslavement. And he says, everybody that buys into this is an extra person, extra people. Have you ever watched the BBC Nature series with David Attenborough and the many lectures and talks that he would give at all these globalist confabs over the last several decades? Well, the extra people, what are we to do? Why? There's so many extra people. It makes me sick in my stomach. There's going to be some way in which we're able to crush and destroy all the extra people to get rid of them. Literally what's on the Georgia Guidestone. Okay, so again, we know this is a real plan. It even says extra people in here, okay, the extra people. He says the key to understanding the future will be a needs-based economy, not an economy where you have sovereignty, where you have private property, where you have wealth, where you have independence, but a completely controlled, tracked, surveilled economy based around needs. Well, who decides what is the need? Oh, they do, you see. A centrally controlled technocratic society, a needs according to an austerity-based presupposition economy, you see. So the needs are determined on the basis of what the system says an individual needs. And by the way, they eventually say that you don't need to be here. You need to go, you see. It goes on to say that everyone who believes in an individual right in any sense whatsoever, whether you're a libertarian or whether you're just an independent anarchist or whether you're a Christian who believes that you're made in the image of God, so you have some individual identity, he says, everyone who believes in any kind of individual identity will be submerged in or submissive to the collective identity. Right? Now, who decides what the collective identity? Oh, well, of course, the technocrats, you see. So this is the transition from rule by politics and so-called democracy, which we all know we don't really have democracy or anything like that, right? There's the front of elected leaders and so forth. There's the frontispiece of all that. But really, we've been, as Quigley, Dr. Quigley says for a long time, controlled by an oligarchical elite. He goes on to say that, no, in the future, you see, everything will be given on the basis of what the system determines that you need, and you will only have posterity if the system decides that you are allowed to have posterity because you're bad for the planet. Now, this is mind-boggling because this is everything that is in the National Socialist program, their agenda when it came to mass sterilizations, when it came to their philosophy. But now it's all just been rebranded as this sort of tech nerd liberalism, and it's all cool. It's all great, right? And he literally says it will be a collectivist austerity-based system. And he talks about, again, this is 1981, tiny houses, tiny living. You will work from home in the future, if you even have work. In 1981, that you would work from home was planned by technocrats in the 70s and 80s. He says that, and this is something you've heard Alex talk about a lot, which Willis Harmon says. He says that this is going to be more like the Middle Ages. Now, trad-minded people are like, oh, yeah, Bayes, trad, it's going to be Middle Ages. No. It's not Middle Ages where you have a feudal lord and you're a knight who, you know, dies for virtuous noble causes. No. This is Mark Zuckerberg is your feudal lord, and he's sitting over there with giant goblets and big chunks of steak, and you're eating kibble on his plantation, you see. It literally says that the Middle Ages – and the idea of the feudal system is more accurately the type of system that they will bring in where you live on the – it's like the company town. So if you don't know about this in American history, there used to be company towns. And the corporation owned the mine and the town and your apartment. And you basically just rented everything that you needed, your gray underwear, your gray worker suit, your gray boots, your gray hat, everything's gray, right? Your gray bread. You just rent that from the company store, and you live on the company property. That's the medieval feudal model. Okay? Nothing to do with being based in trad and medieval. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the worst aspects of medieval feudalism, of monopoly capitalism, of socialism, of democracy. Like all of the worst aspects of all those is what is going into this future system. And he says that we will not have any religions. It will be a purely, quote, science-based system. Technocracy will be science-based. This is the Alex Jones Show. Don't go anywhere. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I want to remind you guys to head on over to the InfoWars store. I actually just bought several things in the past couple of weeks, especially the nascent iodine. I've been taking that every day. I love it. Really great products over there. There's a lot of DVDs, a lot of t-shirts. So definitely support Alex in the InfoWars store and help us keep the fight going. Now, we were talking about Willis Harmon's Millennium essay, where he gets into the role of work itself changing in the future, because all of society will be revolutionized in the future. This is not revolution in some 1776 sense or some, liberal utopia sense. This is the revolution which they call the final revolution, to bring in the total technocratic control. The same people behind this revolution are the same people who helped Hitler, Mao, and Stalin come to power. Now, not everything that those dictators did went along their plans, but at least insofar as they wanted big wars, Cold War, in that regard, the elite did get what they wanted. And that's what we find when we go deep into the writings of the elite in the 20th century, particularly in regard to the history of the British Empire, which I read quite a bit about. Now, before we get to that, though, I want to end what Willis Harmon was saying in the new ethic. He says, just the same as what Klaus says. Remember in Klaus's book, we will need the grand narrative, the great narrative. We need a new story, a new narrative. Same thing Willis Harmon says in 1981. There will be a new ethic, a new story about what makes man virtuous or what makes man bad, good and bad. The new good and bad will be eco-ethics. Ecological ethics, that's everything. They hinged everything on that. Go back to the First Global Revolution from the Club of Rome. It said that we will make humankind the key issue of pollution, not just toxic pollutants in the sense of chemicals, plastics, etc. That's all true. But also human beings are a pollutant. Humans and carbon, in that sense, as carbon is the base of life, those are the real pollutants in the world. They have to be depopulated. And the role of work, the role of everything will change based around, hinged around this linchpin of eco-ethics. But who says eco? What does that even mean? Eco-ethics. Who decides what's the proper number of human beings on the planet to balance out the so-called sustainability agendas? Well, of course, they do. The technocratic elite, they say. Right. So, again, it's totally arbitrary, right? It's not actually justified. There's not a basis for why we should accept this system. It's a top-down authoritarian control, not based on logic. It's on logic. It's on what? Evolution, according to them, and a completely socially planned society that has evolved, according to them, from the individual to the collective. So you see, they just say, oh, evolution proves it. Evolution is evolving from you having individual rights to clearly the technocratic collectivist system. And you are no longer an individual. You're a cell in a macro organism. You're a molecule in a larger system. So you have no identity at all apart from this arbitrary collective. Well, why should we hinge our identity on the collective? Maybe the collective is just made up of individuals. Maybe the individual is the starting point, right? I mean, why should we just assume that collective, the many, is prior to the one? Maybe the one is prior to the many. Maybe the many is prior to the one, right? I have my own views, which I think Orthodox Christianity helps solve that classic philosophical problem. But from these people who don't believe in ethics, who don't believe in metaphysics, don't believe in epistemology, they suppose just believe in, quote, science or scientism, there's no reason or basis to prefer one over the other. There's no such thing as even individuals or collectives. Those don't have any real identity. They're just human social constructs. So you see that this is a totally arbitrary, unjustified, in a philosophical sense, system that is based around pure power politics and social engineering. Now, I was mentioning the origins of this philosophy, right? Now, we know about Malthusianism, and that's, of course, the so-called minister, Thomas Malthus, who looked at flies flying around in a jar and said, so the flies in the jar prove to me that there's limited resources. And so if we don't control the population in England within a generation or two, the whole country will collapse. So it was a fear-based narrative from Malthus back in his day. And then we get out of that the connection to the social Darwinian eugenics movement with the Galtons and the Huxleys and so forth, those families. all premised their ideology on the same idea of Malthusianism, intimately tied to social Darwinism, the idea that just whoever is in power has power because they are, in terms of biology, determined to have that power. And it doesn't matter how they got it. There is no ethic. There's nothing. There's no right or wrong. There's just power narratives, and there's just control, and there's just basically the worship of death. That's essentially what the Darwinian paradigm amounts to, the worship of death. And therefore, it's justified for the elite, in their view, to get rid of most people because they're just furthering the evolutionary mechanism itself, because death is what propels the system in that worldview. Where does this weird idea come from? Because we know that it's clearly opposite anything remotely Christian, right? There's no place at all in whether you're Protestant, classically Protestant, Roman Catholic, Orthodox. There's not really any place at all for this idea of a death cult or a worship of death. I mean, everybody's theology in the West, at least loosely biblically based, believes that death is in some way overcome or the enemy or connected to the devil, right? And so why would we have a death cult? Well, death cults are a return to ancient pagan animistic traditions or druidic traditions where the druids actually would worship death and believe in human sacrifice. That there was a need to placate Mother Earth. She craved blood, and if she didn't get blood, then she would wreak havoc in terms of storms and natural disasters. So it's like an ancient sort of superstitious pagan religion that they revived under the guise of science. And Alex is 100% right when he says that many of the elite documents, UN documents, Arthur Kessler and others, actually said we need to bring back the ancient pagan idea of human sacrifice because they understood the balance of nature and sustainability. So whether the people at the top of the pyramid are outright Satanists and believe that they're offering blood sacrifices to Lucifer himself, or whether they're just naturalists and believe that this is part of the cyclical biological earth process, it doesn't really matter ultimately, because it's the same idea, the same game plan that most people have to be gotten rid of because they're the extra people, the superfluous people. Absolutely superfluous. That's literally what he says. Harmon, superfluous people. Where does this idea come from? Well, if you go back to the Reformation, and particularly after Henry VIII and all that debacle, what grew in English religion was more and more of an interest in not just Enlightenment ideas, but in what we could call Hermeticism. And the Elizabethan period in particular, if you look at most of the literature, especially the arts, right? So English lit and so forth. If you go into the history of John Donne, Ben Jonson, Edmund Spencer, even Shakespeare, you get this sort of pseudo-Christian stuff in the writings, which cloaks Hermetic ideas. And the Hermetic principles there are pushed very clearly, especially when you get into these weird esoteric documents like Edmund Spencer's Fairy Queen. Now you might think, what does this have to do with what you're talking about? Well, when I was doing my grad work, I got pretty deep into Elizabethan literature because so much of that literature was impregnated with pseudo-Christian ideas that cloaked Hermeticism, alchemy, and occult ideas. And particularly in this case, what happened was Elizabeth said, I want you, Edmund, to write for me the great mythological story for the British Empire. So remember, she's the Virgin Queen, supposedly. She has this image where she projected herself as a kind of state-run Virgin Mary. Literally, the artwork and the propaganda at that time projected her as the Virgin Queen, as the Virgin Mary, but she's the state queen. She's not, it's a quasi-religious thing. And so she said, I want Virgil's Aeneid for the British Empire. And so she got Spencer, who was not really Christian, more of an esotericist, to write this hermetic alchemical allegory for the British Empire.